Welcome to this special broadcast of Michigan Calling on the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio. We are going to spend the next hour talking to Governor Rick Snyder, and we will be talking with the governor about issues that matter to Michigan voters, and we know that because the questions are coming from you. Roads, the sales tax, film credits, the economy, education, the environment. What do you want to ask the governor? The phone number to join the conversation is 866-255-2762. Again, that's 866-255-2762. You can message us on Facebook as well. We are at Michigan Calling, or tweet us. Use the hashtag MICalling. Governor Snyder, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Rick.
Okay, we're going to begin the hour with a topic that's been sort of front and center for you a lot lately, and that's roads and infrastructure. And that is actually one that we've heard the most about from our listeners. And we also have an election coming up on that. We're going to start with a question from Nathan on Facebook. And Nathan says, quote, "It is the responsibility of the lawmakers to fix the roads. Instead of doing what everyone wants them to do, they won't raise taxes in order to stay popular with the extremists in their party to get reelected." Nathan's question, Governor, is, why should I vote yes on legislation that allows them to ignore doing their job? Why should I encourage childish pass-the-buck behavior? I think, Nathan, maybe reflects some of the skepticism we're hearing out there.
Yeah, and Rick, I appreciate that. Nathan, I thank you for your question, because I think it's a good opportunity to sort of clear the air, to put things in perspective on this topic. In a perfect world, it would have been nice to get a legislative solution so we wouldn't have to go to the ballot. So if you talk to many people, there's a fair amount of anger about the process, about the fact that this has to go to a vote of the ballot proposal. What I'd ask people to be very careful is they don't confuse that with the actual proposal itself, the policy outcomes. What is the outcome that we're having here? And in fact, if you looked at where we were at, we needed to go to the ballot. So the legislature did their job.
Because this is the sales tax. It's because a constitutional amendment.
Because the constitutional change for the sales tax. And the reason that was required, Rick, is one of the things we wanted to do, and this gets to the other question that comes quite often. People will go, this is really complicated. Well, part of the issue is we had a really complicated system that we're simplifying. So when people look at this as complex, we're actually reducing the simplicity. We're making it simpler by going through this process, which is important. So part of the big issue we had is on our fuel. What we're currently paying today is 19 cents per gallon for roads, for transportation. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we have the retail sales tax, the 6% retail sales tax you pay on other goods and services on our fuel. That's the big problem issue, because if we simply increased our fuel taxes, the price of gas could get too high in the state. So one of the things that was looked at is to say, we want to be competitive for fuel taxes. Let's take the retail sales tax off of fuel. And by doing that, then we can have our fuel taxes, everything on the pump will go to transportation then with mm-hmm. this ballot proposal. But then what we did was we created a hole in funding, particularly for schools and for local government. When we removed the retail sales tax by the order of several hundred millions of dollars. And so the best solution to solve that problem was to increase the retail sales tax from 6% to 7%, which requires a constitutional amendment. In fact, it required a two-thirds vote of both chambers. So we had broad bipartisan support in the legislature to put it on the ballot, and it had to go on the ballot so we could make sure our schools and local governments were being made whole through this process.
Well, since we're talking about that, we actually have another question on roads, mm-hmm. the process, and the ballot question. So let's go to that.
I'm Agnes McDonald. I live here in Mount Pleasant, and I would like to know the truth on the road or on the sales tax, what they're going to spend the money for, if it's all going to go for roads or if it's going to be divvied out to different places.
So sure. to follow up on what you were talking about, explain where this money, if indeed the proposal is passed, where that money will go. And actually, we know that the money from the sales tax actually does not go directly to roads. It's going to replace money that is going to roads.
Yeah.
And then also, just as a follow-up to that, what guarantees can you offer that some future legislature, some future governor won't come in and just change things up?
Well, again, you always have that to some issue. But once it's well established, it stays. So what I would say is the way to look at this overall thing, and I appreciate your question, Agnes, let's talk first about what's on the pump. If you look at what's on the pump, roughly today we have fuel transportation taxes and we have the retail sales tax. The retail sales tax will be eliminated. That would come off. We would have an increase in the transportation tax piece, and all resources, all the taxes on fuels would be going to transportation, 100%. With respect to the sales tax gets divided up already by our Constitution largely. It has parts that go to the school aid fund. It goes to local government for statutory revenue sharing and constitutional revenue sharing. There's other pieces that go to the general fund. But a good chunk of it is to school aid and local governments. Those pieces would, in terms of the 6 to 7%, that would help fill the hole that would otherwise be created by taking it off of fuels. In fact, it would add about $300 million to the school aid fund, about $100 million to local government. We'd actually be taking a couple, $250 million, $260 million tax reduction for lower income people through the general fund.
Right, the earned income tax
credit. For the
earned
income tax credit.
And then there's also money for mass transit.
There is. There's about over $100 million for the Comprehensive Transportation Fund, which is a large piece of that goes to public transportation, which I strongly support. I think that's critically important.
Okay, let's take a phone call now, and you're on the air. This is Frederick in Battle Creek. Frederick, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Governor Snyder.
Good morning, Frederick.
Former classmate of yours. Quick question for you. In the state of Arizona, it is mandated by state law that a certain percentage of rubber be placed in the asphalt roads. If you go to Google and you Google Arizona roads, asphalt, rubber, you will come up with a complete report. It increases the longevity of the roads by 30-plus percent. What we're doing right now with our roads, I mean, they are a mess, but let's create something that provides us with better roads.
Frederick, do you have a question?
Yes. Did you not hear what I said?
So you want to know if Michigan will put more recycled rubber into the its road
Correct.
Building?
Let's produce a better product, a better road.
Frederick, right. I'm not familiar with, to be open with you, the rubber content on asphalt. I'm happy to go look at that. So that's something that, that's a new topic for me, happy to go look at. One of the issues on our roads, to put it in perspective, is the money we've had hasn't been enough. So in a lot of cases, we've been just patching or making temporary solutions when, with these additional resources, we can make long-term solutions, which will actually save us money long-term. So this is actually safer roads, and let's fix our roads right with this proposal.
Okay, and we're going to move on to another question about roads.
This is Rob Zimmerman from Royal Oak. My question is, when the referendum for the roads, if it doesn't pass, what happens next? How do we get our roads fixed?
Governor, and that's a very good question. I mean, what do we have by way of a plan B? If, in fact, this is a public safety issue, as you've said it is, wouldn't it just be responsible to have a plan and a backup plan?
Well, I always like to have backup plans. Quite often I have multiple backup plans, Rick. This was one case, though, because of the legislative process and how we worked through it. There isn't a good plan B. In fact, I would have preferred to have done this differently in the big picture in some ways, in terms of a proposal A, kind of here's choice A or choice B solution. But that wasn't possible in this situation. So what I would say is that's why it's so critically important we get this ballot proposal approved. If we don't, I think we're actually going to go backwards in terms of where we are about getting a solution. Because, as you know, you're familiar with the process, that if the voters go out and vote down a tax increase, individual legislators are probably going to be more hesitant to talk about a tax increase than they were even before. So that's one of the real challenges here, and that's why it's really important we get everybody on board to solve our roads. No one likes them, and they need to be safer.
So if you have to go back to the legislature, what's the minimum amount that we need to dump in, you know, right now to keep things going? Because you would have to find that money within the budget. Is it $100 million, $200 million, $500 million?
Well, that's why we've been really talking about the $1.2 billion number, Rick. And I've been consistent about that for several years. What we've been doing in the interim, to go to your point, is we've been using general fund money to sort of reduce the problem some. So we've used anywhere from 100 and some million to $300 to $400 million in general fund money in the last 2 or 3 years for roads, but that's not a sufficient answer. For example, in this next year's budget, I'm proposing another $100 and some million.
Okay, well, let's take another question from Facebook. This one is from Michael, who writes, quote, Please detail what efforts have been made to audit current road expenditures versus what other states are paying. Also, please detail what efforts have been made to find other sources of tax revenues currently collected to fund roads. We sure do pay a lot in taxes, but seem to get very little for it. And let's go with the first part of that, road audits. As a matter of fact, there was just an Auditor General report about that, and it was not complimentary.
Well, it was on warranties. And one of the things is warranties are relatively new to the transportation industry. And one good thing I can tell you, Michigan's a leader in actually doing warranties at the state level. So we've got more warranties in Michigan than any other state in the nation. And we did need to improve some of our practices about following up on those warranties, because it's something that everyone's learning experience. And it was very timely, because one of the requirements of this proposal, that one of the tie-barred bills that go with it, is to actually increase warranties happening. For basically projects over $1 million, there would be warranty requirements. With respect to projects over $100,000, there'd be competitive bidding. There's also a piece of legislation that I think is very important that talks about doing more preventative maintenance, and really requires preventive maintenance plans from the state and from several of our largest counties.
Well, let's follow up on that, because we have another Facebook question from Marion, and this one is about truck weights. Quote, why not work to lower the amount of weight trucks carry on Michigan roads, especially since Michigan has the highest allowed weights in the country? And I don't know if it's the highest in the country, but it certainly is the highest in the region.
Well, it's among the highest in the country, and part of the reason we do that is because there's been a lot of engineering analysis to say the issue is not necessarily the weight of the truck, but the weight per axle. And so one of the issues you get back and forth, is it the truck weight or the weight per axle?
Right.
If you use the per axle, we're actually in a much more reasonable standard, because the issue is if you say you're going to change the truck weights, you're just going to add more trucks on the road, which can do more damage. So there's this balancing act of how to get through that. We actually are looking to increase the fees on truck weights.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Governor. We are going to take a short break here. And when we come back, more of your questions. You're listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Rick Snyder on the Michigan Public Radio Network. Welcome back. I'm Rick Pluta here with Governor Rick Snyder, and we are taking your questions. The number is 866-255-2762. Again, 866-255-2762. You can also ask a question on Facebook, find us at Michigan Calling, tweet us, use the hashtag MICalling. Okay, let's jump back to questions from listeners and talk education.
My name is Howard Harding, and I live in Marquette, Michigan. My question is there a way that we can increase the total funding for the education system in Michigan, both K-12 and later college or technical education for the students beyond high school?
Yeah, Howard, with respect to your question, I'm proud to say we have been making significant increases in educational spending. Since the time I've become governor, it's up over $1 billion compared to the year before I became governor. So we've made major increases in those dollars each and every year that I've been governor, for K-12 in particular. But that's something that, again, it's not just about how much we're spending, it's about measuring student growth. I'm also happy to say we've made good increases for community colleges, particularly career tech education. That's a top priority. There's a huge opportunity for the skilled trades. University funding, I had a challenge the first year in office. We had a big budget deficit. Actually, I had to make some reductions there, and we're trying to get those restored over time, and we're making some reasonable progress.
When do you think that we'll reach the point where at least where higher education is breaking even where it was?
Well, universities in particular, Rick? Yeah, we're not that far off. What I would say is probably within another year or two. I actually had hoped to do some of that. Then we had the challenge because of some of the revenue forecasting that otherwise probably would have been restored, but for the challenges and the reduced revenue sharing estimates.
Okay, and we have another question from the UP. This one is from Northern Michigan. This is from Ann in Petoskey.
Hi, this is Ann from Petoskey.
Hi,
Ann. I would like to ask about the $250 million that was moved from the school aid fund to the general fund. When is that going to be put back to the school aid fund?
Actually, Ann, if you look at the numbers, most of the dollars that we have, there are some shifts going back and forth. But it's really helping cover community colleges and some university funding in the school aid fund. And if you go to Michigan's constitution, that's actually part of the constitutionally allowed areas.
Although if this ballot question passes, mm-hmm. you would not be allowed to move money from the school aid fund to universities.
That would be correct, Rick. And so I think that would work fine. Again, we had some questions where we didn't have the whole budget in either budget, so this would actually clarify it. I'd be happy to see the community college budget and the school aid fund and the university budget back in the general fund.
Okay, all three of them together?
Well, no, what you'd have is the general fund. All the universities funding would go back to the general fund then, and we do community colleges. One of the areas in particular that I liked with the school aid fund with the community college piece is if you look, moving from K-12 into community college, particularly with career tech ed, is a very similar area. So I think that's a great use of school aid fund dollars.
Okay. Bonnie has a question on Facebook. You touched on it. Mm-hmm. Quote, Governor, when do you plan to support our Michigan universities at a reasonable level? The 2% increase in the higher education budget plus the meager increases of the last couple of years do not yet recoup the 15% cut of 2011. So talk a little bit about where universities – you've talked a lot about workforce and community colleges. Where do universities fit into that picture?
Well, they are a priority. I put a higher priority on career tech ed and community college, and so the next level is the universities. And I've actually had a slide in the last two budget years, Rick, talking about the need to restore those dollars, and that was a focus point. What if the 2% people like to talk that as a meager increase, that's actually above the inflation rate. So we're actually trying to show we're trying to bring it back at a higher level, and we're making progress.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about Detroit, and we have Tom on the phone from Detroit, and I think he wants to talk about the schools there and emergency management. Tom?
Yes, good morning to both of you. Governor, you were quoted in the Detroit News as saying that the emergency manager has not worked for Detroit students, and even Nolan Finley said the same thing. Then why would you go and appoint a fourth emergency manager, meaning Mr. Darnell Early? Yeah, if you know, and you even said it yourself that the emergency managers aren't working. Now I don't understand how you can say it doesn't work, but you went and appointed Mr. Early.
Yeah, what I'd say is that they are working, but not as effectively as what I'd like. The goal with an emergency manager, in my view, is they should be able to come in, do their work in 18 months, and leave. And so my comment is really a reflection of the fact that we've had more than one emergency manager.
So what's the holdup in Detroit?
Goal, well, the magnitude of the issues, the challenges, because they still are in crisis mode. If you look at particularly from a financial point of view, but also in terms of student achievement, we still need to see major improvement there. But first, let's solve the financial issue, and that's the primary role of the emergency manager if you look at the way the statute's outlined. So one of the questions is we need to look at broader answers, in my case, beyond just the Detroit Public Schools. And that's why I was very encouraging and supportive of the coalition effort that's taking place that's looking at education in Detroit. So what I'm really hoping that as part of the solution of not only what Darnell Early's doing, but I'm hoping the coalition led by the Skillman Foundation will come out with good recommendations that will help education, DPS, and all forms of education.
Highland Park, Flint, all the school districts that are...
They're really focused on Detroit, Rick, at this point in time. What I'd hope is if they have good recommendations, they may be applicable to some other communities.
Okay. We have a question on Twitter. This one is from Melanie. And will you reconsider your support for the Common Core standards?
Well, Common Core, let me start by asking the first question that I think people jump over too often. Do we think we should have high standards for our students? I think everyone agrees we should have high standards for our students. The question is, how do you achieve that? And this is where there's a lot of so much misinformation about Common Core. I've been a supporter of Common Core, and I will continue to be, because that was really done by the states coming together. I think some people are finding an objection now that the federal government has gotten so involved, they view it as federal government getting overly involved in education. But the concept of having high standards for our kids is appropriate, in my view. And we also shouldn't confuse that. That's not saying here's the curriculum, here's how it's being taught. It's really we want high standards and bars that our kids need to achieve, though.
Do the people in your party who don't support Common Core, including your own lieutenant governor, do they just have it wrong?
Well, again, I'm not going to. The lieutenant governor, I believe, is more supportive than your comment would indicate. But what I would say is Common Core is an area that attracts a lot of attention. Is that lightning rod issue right now? And again, if you look at the substance behind it, the idea of having high standards for our kids is a good one. And I'll give you a great illustration, Rick, of how we can show you can balance those things. One change I was proud of this last year is I signed some legislation really allowing more flexibility in the Michigan merit curriculum to allow more career tech education. We didn't drop the standards at all. What the issue is Algebra 2,
this
for example.
This is the algebra taking construction or
Yeah, but you can do it in the context of a construction course. You don't need to sit in a course called Algebra 2 and learn as X, Y, and Z. You can learn it as to say this angle has to go to that angle or you're building a roof, so you have to have the angles done right.
Okay, well, let's go to another question.
Hello, I'm Judy Gipper from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Governor, I'm concerned about the incidence of child poverty in the state of Michigan. I've seen information that approximately 20% of the children in our state live at or below the poverty line, and their access to nutritious food and their ability to have a nutritious diet is compromised along with other factors. And I would like to know what the state of Michigan is going to do to effectively address this problem.
Yeah, Judy, we're doing a lot, but there's a lot more to be done. Two or three things I would tell you with respect to children and poverty and the nutrition issue in particular. One is we've got programs within the schools that we clearly encourage kids to get signed up. There are a lot of kids not signing up for the full program of meals they're all eligible for, and that's important. But beyond that, how do you solve the underlying issue of the poverty? And that's where it's critically important. And one program I'm really proud of is Community Ventures. That's a program we started with solely state dollars several years ago to focus on the structurally unemployed. And we've successfully placed over 3,000 people now with a retention rate of nearly 70%, which is really good for programs like that. It's providing wrap services. It's getting people employed so they have an opportunity to get out of poverty and help bring their children with them. So that's critically important. Another program that goes with it to help kids in particular and their families is Pathways to Potential. This is where we're moving caseworkers from the government office into the local schools, and they're able to interface with the kids and their families directly, finding out what their issues are and how we can better provide services. And one illustration, one metric of success is we've dropped chronic absenteeism in those schools by over a third, by about 33%. And that's a huge improvement. But again, they're looking at nutrition. They're looking at other issues on how to help these young people.
Let's circle back for a moment, though. You said that not enough kids are signing up for breakfast and lunch programs. And if that is the case, and children who are hungry will not learn, we know that. If that is the case, what is the state doing to try and get more kids and their parents to sign them up?
Well, I've actually gone to schools to help encourage people to do this, Rick. So there are programs. Quite often people think of the lunch, but quite often there may be a breakfast program available. Quite often during summertime, a number of these programs, depending on where they live, may be available, and they're not thinking about coming in to avail themselves of those programs. And that's where we need to do more marketing and communication. That's why I like programs like Pathways, where you have people, we have caseworkers right in the school to make sure they can make a first-person recommendation.
Does your budget recommendation reflect more marketing and communication to get kids signed up for
I don't believe we have a specific line item for that, but again, that's part of our role, hopefully doing good communication on what programs are available, and hopefully the schools are doing it themselves.
Okay, well, let's turn now to questions about jobs and the economy, and another one from Mount Pleasant.
My name's Ed Berthold from Mount Pleasant. I'm curious as to what you can do to help bring some jobs back to Michigan from China and other places. Thanks.
Ed, I appreciate your question. We've actually we've created a lot of jobs in Michigan, over 300,000 private sector jobs in the last 4 years. That makes us number 6 in the nation for the number of private sector jobs created in the last few years. But this is something that we need to continue. And Michigan is making a strong economic resurgence. So one of the areas that I think we have great opportunity are career tech education, the skilled trades. Actually, we have over 80,000 open jobs in Michigan today that aren't being filled. Many of these are good, well-paying jobs, and we need to do more to get our young people and people looking for that next career or looking for work connected with the right training so they can take these jobs.
And is there anything in your research that reflects that that would mean that manufacturing jobs that are overseas would return to Michigan in the Midwest?
A lot of that's actually taking place already, Rick. In terms of a great illustration is if you look at Ford, look at the Flat Rock facility. They actually brought manufacturing back from Mexico in terms of fusion production back to Michigan. We're seeing it in a number of cases where we're seeing actually strong investment in the United States from overseas companies because they believe they don't want to make it overseas. They actually want to manufacture in Michigan. So we're one of the leading states in the nation in terms of foreign inbound investment.
When you talk about skilled trades, that's a wide array of job types. And you know, Rick Haglund, who writes the a very good Michigan economy blog, I mean, he knows a lot about this, says that where the state seems to be directing its resources isn't necessarily where those skilled trade jobs are being created. How are we tracking that so that we're matching the workers and the training to what's really needed?
Well, what I'd say is in terms of the state, we're helping facilitate that. Again, our role isn't to be a placement agency for everyone, but to be kind of the coordinator, the clearinghouse, to bring the private sector together with the education sector and the other parties involved in this. And we just had a two-day summit that was very successful, where we brought
the economy and education summit in Detroit.
Yeah, and that worked really well because we had a great discussion. And when you said the skilled trades, I define it very, very broadly. Most positions today, in many respects, are a skilled trade position. Again, welder, electrician, plumber are what we always think
healthcare.
Of. Healthcare. But if you think about it, if you're in agriculture today and you're driving a $250,000 tractor that runs on GPS, you're a skilled tradesperson. If you're in manufacturing and you're running robotics equipment or industrial automation, quite often you're a skilled tradesperson. And so that is some of the key programs. One program we did create that's right in the sweet spot is MAT Squared, the Michigan Advanced Technician Training Program, an apprenticeship model that I encourage people to look at potentially joining if they're interested. It's doing a field called mechatronics. And most of us are not familiar with mechatronics, but what it is it's the European term for combining mechanical and electronics together. Particularly in the factory setting, if you think about it, those are great, well-paying jobs that are not going to go away.
Okay, let's go to the phones and another question. This one is from Bob.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. Governor. Thanks for joining us.
I wasn't sure there was no setup. I really wanted to talk about the dismal mental health care in the state, but on the way to the program, I heard on NPR that GM decided to reinvest $10 billion in their own stock because they have so much cash on hand. I was wondering what we can do about reinstating some corporate taxes to pay for all this that is on the list here, highways and otherwise.
Okay, Governor, talk a little bit about how much should businesses be asked to foot?
Yeah, and I think we are asking for a fair amount. We redid our tax system in Michigan, to give you an idea. We put in a simple, fair, efficient corporate income tax. And the way it's set up is it's basically, there are some adjustments, but not a lot. And it's basically taking your net income times 6%. If you compare it to our individual income tax rate, which is 4.25%, 6% is actually a higher rate by a significant margin. So I think we are asking for a good contribution there. And your question on mental health, what I would say is we've actually done some really good things in Michigan. We had a mental health commission led by Jim Habeman and the lieutenant governor this last year that came out with a lot of great recommendations that we're following through on because I think we can do more. The other part that's been a huge boom is Healthy Michigan. Now we're able to provide a lot of mental health services that we weren't before to hardworking but lower income people, and that's been a huge success. We over 550,000 Michiganders now in Healthy Michigan.
Is there too much corporate welfare still in the Michigan tax code?
No, not in terms of ongoing what we had. We still have this legacy of the tax credits, and I wouldn't use the term corporate welfare. Again, these are our job creators. But what I would say is in terms of incentives and different things we've done, Rick, I've never been a big fan of big incentives. And so we've tried to get out of that business. When I first came into office, We stopped doing all new credits, and we put in a new program that's significantly lower cost, dramatically lower cost.
Because you try to appropriate the money up front as opposed to giving credits. And they have contributed to the budget problems that we have right now, or that you hopefully
solve. Yeah, there's a legacy hangover problem that we have from the prior administration.
But because we knew the tax credits were out there, we didn't know when they were going to be cashed in, but we knew how many were out there. How did we get so caught by surprise on this?
Well, a couple things. One is we didn't know the full extent of them either, Rick, in terms of size, because they were not capped when they were issued in terms of some maximum amount. So one of the challenges is they are tax credits. So they go through their tax returns, which then gets into the Revenue Act, which basically provides confidentiality on a lot of that information. So it really made a case. It was kind of a unique case where, as governor, as an elected official, I'm not allowed access to much of that information.
Okay. Let's just quickly get to one more question while we still have time.
I'm Tinashe Kuvaruno from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And my question is, what's your solution for immigration? Do you have a permanent solution for immigrants or not?
I know this matters to you. You have one minute to answer.
Yeah, Tinashe, I'm very much I believe in immigration. And I believe we need a comprehensive immigration reform at the national level. The federal government needs to do something to solve this problem for both legal and illegal immigration so we can move forward. Our country was made a great place, and one of the top five reasons in my book is immigration. So let's get a better answer. And then I want to encourage in particular immigration in challenged communities such as Detroit. I think that would be a huge economic boom. And I've been working with the mayor and the city council on potentially having a good proposal there that we've pitched to the national government.
Quickly, when do you expect to get an answer from the federal government on these special visas for urban areas?
Yeah, that's taken some time, Rick. What I would say is having the election season didn't help. So we're getting that back on track now so we can make it a higher priority, hopefully in Washington.
And when do you expect that you might hear back from them?
Sometime this year, I would hope.
Okay. Well, we are going to take a short break here. But when we come back, we will have more of your questions for Governor Snyder. You are listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Rick Snyder, right here on the stations of the Michigan Public Radio Network. And welcome back to Michigan Calling. I'm Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio, here with Governor Rick Snyder, taking your calls, your questions. The phone number to join us is 866-255-2762. Again, that's 866-255-2762. You can message us on Facebook. We are at Michigan Calling. Tweet us. Use the hashtag MICalling. What questions do you have for Governor Snyder? Well, let's start with a question on Facebook from Steve. One of the biggest threats to our Great Lakes is a 62-year-old oil pipeline that sends 23 million gallons of crude oil per day through the Straits of Mackinac. The Great Lakes are arguably Michigan's greatest asset, and a leak here would be catastrophic to our pristine waters. With that in mind, why are you playing Russian roulette with this pipeline instead of demanding that it be either decommissioned or rerouted around the Great Lakes? And you're familiar with this particular pipeline. It actually runs through some natural areas. It's a joint federal state issue dealing with permission to run it. Where do you stand on all that?
Yeah, well, this
this pipeline is a big concern. And it's going underneath the Great Lakes up by the Straits. One thing we do need to remember, it's been there for decades. So it's been there for decades, and in many cases...
Actually, it's been there since before they had to be permitted.
And many of us weren't even aware there was really a pipeline until this issue got more attention, which it should get more attention. It is primarily a federal issue. They are the regulator, but we're being active on this. And the way we're handling it is I've asked Dan Wyatt, our director of the Department of Environmental Quality, to work with the Attorney General and really talk to the company that has the pipeline. And really, we've asked him a series of very tough questions. And we're going through that process of going back and forth on these questions to see what real issues, what we can narrow down to say what are appropriate steps that may need to be taken to ensure either the safety of this pipeline or what other options may be available. Again, rerouting is difficult because, again, you know, there's the realities of the Great Lakes. That would be a lot of area to go around if you're not going under the lakes in some fashion. But again, we have to think of the Great Lakes first and foremost.
Is there anything specific that you would like to see coming out of that that review by the Agriculture Department, the Attorney General of the Enbridge pipeline?
Well, there's a whole series of things, Rick, because again, you get the whole issue about what's the maintenance cycles, what's being done, what are the pressures, what are the plans in the event there is a problem. So you have this whole question about getting good information, what's the maintenance plan, what's the investment plan, what's the long-term plan, if there's any problem issues, how do we follow through and make sure we're safe?
Okay, and we're going to go to the phones now where we have a question from John.
Hello, this is John Kurczewski in Indian River. Hello, Governor. Is there any plans to ban fracking in the state of Michigan? The reason why I say this is right now, many news stories have reported that there's a glut of oil on the market, and we're running out of places to store it. In all my research, it shows that we could right now replace oil and natural gas with solar, wind, geothermal. And this would provide the jobs that would have been lost to drilling for gas and oil. And I'm also not too thrilled about the state constantly offering acres up for drilling for natural gas when we should be going more solar and natural.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for that, John. And as a matter of fact, Governor, you have an energy policy message that's coming up sometime soon.
Near term, yeah, within the next couple weeks or so. So I'm really looking forward to that. And so your question's very timely, John. A couple things I'd mention to you is we actually have seen some major progress, particularly with wind in Michigan. Solar is approaching to a point where we can see more solar in Michigan. So those are very good things going on. What I would say is, as a total replacement, that's not near term for a number of reasons, one of which is they tend to be intermittent power, where they're not there 24 hours, 24/7. So one of the challenges is they can be helpful, but you still need this baseload power, which quite often would come from coal, natural gas, you know, oil. Natural gas is a great resource in Michigan, and we're going to see more of that being used to go along with renewables, I hope. But with respect to the question on fracking specifically, what I would say is Michigan is actually a state that's – we've fracked over 10,000 wells in the state of Michigan with very little problem. No major issues at all.
Although the current system for fracking is somewhat different than what's been
done in past decades.
Yeah, and
the current system, as technology has evolved, Rick, fracking has gone to new levels of going deeper and more sophisticated. But we've been trying to keep up with that. In fact, one of the things I did in my last energy message is I made a call and we partnered with the University of Michigan on having them do research through the Graham Sustainability Institute to look at where the future of fracking rules should go. And right now we're looking at going through the rulemaking process about enhancing our rules on fracking to make sure Michigan keeps the great safety record that we have. There have been other states that haven't done fracking right, and they've paid a price for it. So I'm proud of our track record in Michigan, and we want to stay on the front edge of doing it in an environmentally sound fashion.
Okay, well, let's go to another question on the environment.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'm from Saginaw. I had heard that the legislature is considering a bill that would include burning trash and calling it renewable energy. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to sign a bill that included that.
Yeah, that's something that there's a state representative that just introduced some legislation that would involve treating essentially incineration of waste as part of renewable standard in some fashion. And again, that's something that would require some homework on because, again, the normal definition of renewables that we think about would be wind, solar, other capacities like that.
Okay, and we're going to move on to a new topic now, social issues. And this one is from Facebook, from Jim. Quote, working in real estate, I find that people offered jobs at Michigan State University and graduates of MSU, and I would guess by extension other universities, do not want to come to or stay in Michigan due to not having equal marriage rights for same-sex couples. It is now available in 37 states. And his question, why are we lagging behind other states in moving forward on these social issues?
Well, with respect to the marriage question, it's a very complicated issue where people have strong feelings, but from a legal point of view, the answer is very simple. That was a constitutional amendment in Michigan's Constitution quite a few years ago that defined marriage between a man and a woman. It's in Michigan's Constitution. So the real question is that the legality of that? And that's what's being tested now, and that's what's before the U.S. Supreme Court. So with respect to the question, Jim, at least I believe we should get clarity by summertime, because the case is being heard and there should be a decision this summer. So hopefully we'll get a clear answer as to whether that's appropriate or not.
Governor, right after a federal judge ruled on same-sex marriage here in Michigan, 300 couples more or less got married in the one-day window. At the time, you said that they were married, but the state could not recognize them. Then, in light of a different court ruling, you decided to recognize the marriages, not to appeal it, not to pursue it. Why?
Well, again, this is where it gets complicated legally, Rick. Actually, if you go back to the first instance, it was more complicated than that. So what happened is it was allowed, the marriages took place, 300 couples were married. I actually came out and said they're legally married. Then it was a different court. The Court of Appeals issued a stay on that ruling. So essentially, they were legally married, but then I had to change that view to say, well, they may be legally married, but given the stay of the Court of Appeals, we can't recognize their benefits because that's the order of the Court of Appeals. Then there was another set of cases that you're referring to where a federal district judge just came out and brought up more questions on that, on the 300. So again, I'm following the law.
But it seems like you kind of put your foot down there and said enough is enough, that we are not going to appeal this district court decision the way that the DeBoer decision, the larger marriage question, was not.
Well, it's consistent with what I did before until I was essentially told what to do by a court of appeals.
Mm-hmm. But you decided not to go to the court of appeals this time.
No.
Because?
Well, again, I think we've had enough litigation on this matter, and hopefully we'll get a final resolution from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay, well, let's move on to another question.
Marshall LeClaire, Shepherd, Michigan. Governor Snyder, how can you justify granting faith-based adoption agencies the legislative right to deny services to LGBT couples or any other couples that do not fit the criteria of a faith-based, moral-valued agency?
Okay, and we should say that this is not a decision that's been made by the administration. This is a bill that is before the legislature. Mm-hmm. It's on the floor of the State House of Representatives. How would you like to see that issue proceed?
Well, we're having a lot of discussions with House members about what that bill says and what might be appropriate. So we're going through that process because the key issue when you talk about adoptions is we want kids to be with great, loving people that want to raise them, that they're going to be successful in. And in Michigan, I'm very proud of our track record that we've seen an improvement in our adoption rate in the state of Michigan by over 25 percentage points in the time I've been in office. And I want to see that continue in terms of positive movement. So one of the questions is how do we make sure we have an environment where we have more people interested in adopting kids successfully? And one of the questions here is will we have more or less agencies? What kind of adoptions will take place? Rick, you actually made some good comments. I saw you on Off the Record talking about the experience in some other states. So I'm going to make sure we look at what other states have been doing and their experiences.
Well, and that was part of the federal court trial, which mm-hmm. I covered, that there was a finding that where these sorts of laws don't exist, that more kids get adopted. The state is still in federal court in another case over its foster care system and permanent placements. Is that going to be the critical question for you? Just which one causes more kids to be adopted?
Well, again, one of the things, if you think about it, our adoption system, isn't that the most important question?
Is it?
Well, again, in many cases, is making sure our kids have loving people raising them in a very constructive, positive way. That's the point of adoption. And so one of the key criteria is to say, how can we make sure we're being successful on that and also making sure we're complying with the law? Because, again, this is a whole series of federal laws and state laws, And this is one of those cases where I could see more and more lawsuits coming about.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones. Kim from Ann Arbor.
Hi. America slams Michigan for being the prison capital with 50,000 inmates, including approximately 15,000 psychotropic drug users. They have to be treated for post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar. And us Michigan residents, we're paying our state taxes. America's paying federal taxes. Plus, some of us with loved ones are paying $5,000 to $25,000 per year, buying them food, clothing, phone calls, and this is more money going back to the state of Michigan. My question is, what month will you be drastically reducing the nonviolent prison population?
Okay. Nonviolent offenders.
Yeah.
What?
Actually, that's something that we are seriously looking at. I'm planning on doing a message on criminal justice reform. And there was some legislation I was generally supportive of at the later part of the last legislative session talking about some sentencing reform. We've gotten some good feedback from national groups that are experts in this field on that we have the room to improve, and I think that's an area we should be looking at.
Here's another question, this one from Facebook on an issue that you've had to confront recently, and that's regarding who can carry a gun where in Michigan. And this is from Melissa, who asks, quote, why do Michigan laws permit people to openly carry guns into schools? Can we get legislation to create real gun-free zones? And this is a controversy, yeah. And it's a complex one, because what it says is that if you have a concealed pistol license, you may openly carry in schools, which one makes some people uncomfortable. Other people think that it's not a problem. And two, it is certainly confusing.
It is very confusing. And if you go back in history, I think that's something that I'm not sure – this was before I came to office – is I'm not sure that was the real intent through the whole process. And so one of the challenges we had – this was a year or two ago – was some people talked about potentially having that go away but then increasing the number of concealed weapons in essentially no-carry zones. And that's a challenging question too. So this is not an easy subject matter.
It is not. Should people be allowed to openly carry a firearm in a school?
Well, again, this is where you have to respect the Second Amendment. And the other one is what's legislatively viable. So I don't see that change really going through the legislature anytime soon unless it was part of a bigger package that included other gun reforms.
Okay. And we're going to go back to the phones. And Pam, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hello, Pam.
Yes.
Your question.
Hello? Yes, I was wondering what can be done to help individuals who are losing their community mental health services or may have already lost them. They're in a group who are not eligible for Medicaid because their income's above 100% of the federal poverty level, but they're not able to get Healthy Michigan because they have Medicare, even though they may be low income. The problem is Medicare doesn't cover case management or assertive community treatment and that sort of thing. And because of the decrease in general funds, these individuals are losing services that they really need.
Okay. Is this something you're familiar with, Governor?
To some degree, Pam, and it'd be great if you have any interest. If you want to give more information to the people at the station, we'll be happy to try to follow up with you and understand more specifically. Because there is some transition going on with some of the mental health services where we are transitioning more from, say, payments simply to counties to more having them get services reimbursed through Healthy Michigan or Medicare or other programs. And if there's some gap or holes that we might be missing, I'd like to know about that so we can make sure we're identifying if we have service gaps where we could do a better job.
On the Medicaid expansion, right now there is a critical case that's before the United States Supreme Court that would affect Michigan and other states that instead of setting up their own exchanges, which you wanted but did not get, are part of the federal exchange. What do you do if the United States Supreme Court says that Michigan people who signed up under the healthcare law no longer qualify for the incentives?
Yeah, a couple things, Rick. First of all, it doesn't affect the Medicaid piece.
It doesn't, but
Healthy Michigan stays in place with 500 and some thousand. There's really several hundred thousand people, though.
But it
that
does
are
have an effect on the ranks of the uninsured.
That are above that,
right.
That at our higher income level that are getting the tax subsidy in some fashion. So what this does is say it doesn't affect them on the exchange directly, but it takes potentially takes away the ability for them to get a tax subsidy, which is a huge issue. So that is going through the Supreme Court. What I would say is there's two layers to that. First of all, there's a layer to say Congress is actually having some reasonable discussions, and I need to credit Congressman Fred Upton. He's one of the leaders in trying to say, well, if this happens, let's just not leave a hole. What are constructive solutions to the Affordable Care Act? So hopefully progress can be made there if the decision comes out, you know, against those benefits. The other one is that raises a question, should we be looking at a state exchange again? And that's a dialogue I'd have to have with the legislature. It was interesting that at one point I had the House in favor of a state exchange, and then I couldn't get the Senate, and then later the Senate wanted an exchange and vice versa. So that's a fair question that would have to be asked, assuming the decision comes out in an adverse fashion.
So you might go back to the legislature and say, look, it's time to revisit this and do a state exchange.
Well, I would say that's premature at this point. But again, we would first wait to see what the decision is. And secondly, is there other congressional action taking place?
Okay, we're going to go to another Facebook question, this one from Richard. And we've gotten a lot of questions about the film incentives. Richard asks, at a time when Michigan is trying to wean itself from the auto industry, abandoning the film industry tax incentives is pure folly and a prime example of partisan politics at work. These incentives have worked and, if allowed to continue, would establish a solid film production industry in this state. Richard obviously has a strong opinion on this, but I think what he may be referring to is that people who back this say that all of the constant tinkering with it and debating it and going back and revisiting the issue have actually sabotaged the film incentives and discouraged film companies, basically taking away confidence in them. What should happen to give the film incentives a chance, but still, you know, deal with the budget issues that you want to deal with?
Yeah, and I think there is some real validity to what you said in terms of, you know, a chilling effect on the marketplace. But what I would say is again, I was never a fan of these to begin with, but they were there when I came to office. So my view is people were making investment decisions, people were doing it. So there should be some rational phasing of this in terms of ramping it down as the industry is established, but we needed some cap on it.
We have to leave it there, Governor. Thank you for your time this hour. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. Michigan Calling, produced by Zoe Clark, Joe Lindstruth, Jake Neer, Laura Weber Davis, Bob Scon engineered the program. Thanks to Michigan Radio for hosting us here. I'm Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network. And this has been a special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network.